Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, John Dennis here on Wednesday, October the 8th. Today, a rescue package for British banks. But will it calm the markets? Also today in the United States, John McCain and Barack Obama face each other in a televised debate, this time taking questions from voters. And the Russian President Dmitry Medvedev shows his new technology credentials. He's made a podcast.
Первый раз использую такую форму общения, обращения через свой сайт.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis from guardian.co.uk.
First, today's news headlines and the papers.
I'm Matt Wells. The Chancellor has announced a £50 billion bailout for British banks. It means the government will invest the money directly in the institutions, taking a partial shareholding, in effect a part nationalisation. There'll also be more money available from government funds for banks to lend and keep business going. We'll have the full details shortly. The world markets continue to be in turmoil, with the Asian markets falling by as much as 10% after a further downturn in New York. The British stock market opened over 200 points down even before the Chancellor's statement, after another torrid day yesterday. In the United States, John McCain and Barack Obama have met in the second of their live television debates, this one held in Nashville, Tennessee. They clashed over both the economy and foreign policy. Both agreed that the present economic crisis was the worst since the Depression of the 1930s and supported the bailout plan passed by Congress last week. But Senator Obama said the problem was the deregulation of the financial system and the power of business lobbyists. Senator McCain responded waspishly.
You know, nailing down Senator Obama's various tax proposals is like nailing Jell-O to the wall. There's been five or six of them, and if you wait long enough, there'll probably be another one. But he wants to raise taxes. My friends, the last president to raise taxes during tough economic times was Herbert Hoover, and he practiced protectionism as well, which I'm sure we'll get to at some point. You know, last year, up to this time, we've lost 700,000 jobs in America. The only bright spot is that over 300,000 jobs have been created by small businesses. Senator Obama's secret that you don't know is that his tax increases will increase taxes on 50% of small business revenue.
On foreign policy, McCain clung to his record as a Vietnam veteran who knew many of the world's present trouble spots. He accused Obama of talking loudly about what he would do without having the power to achieve anything. Obama jeered back.
Now, Senator McCain suggests that somehow, you know, I'm green behind the ears and, you know, I'm just spouting off and he's somber and responsible. Senator McCain, this is the guy who sang Bomb, 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 Iran, who called for the annihilation of North Korea. That I don't think is an example of speaking softly. This is the person who, after we hadn't even finished Afghanistan, where he said, next up, Baghdad.
First polls in the US suggested both men did pretty well with the voters, with neither landing a knockout blow. Here with his assessment is the editor of Guardian America, Michael Tomasky.
I thought tonight's town forum debate was actually more interesting for what didn't happen than for what did happen. Because think about the run-up to this event. The McCain people kept saying that they were going to take the gloves off, that it was time to start raising questions about Obama's real character and who's the real Barack Obama, and he pals around with former terrorists and all of these kinds of things. And none of that ever, ever, ever came up. There wasn't a question about Obama's character. There wasn't a culture war question, which was very interesting to me. Not a single question about abortion or anything like that. There wasn't a question that, in other words, that gave McCain a legitimate opportunity to pivot away from answering the question and then saying, oh, by the way, have I told you about Obama's friendship with this guy, Bill Ayers, who's a former terrorist and blah, 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 blah. So McCain didn't have a chance to do any of those kinds of things. So what does that mean? Well, I think that probably means that, you know, failing that opportunity, McCain needed to score his punches in other ways, other more substantive ways, ways that had more to do with the issues. And I don't think he quite landed them. Now, the early focus group immediate post-debate polls say that Obama won, you know, a narrow, respectable but narrow victory. The first one says that he won by 12 points, 39 to 27. That felt about right to me. I thought Obama just put on a sort of higher energy performance. McCain was a little bit lower energy. Certainly on the economy, I thought Obama's answers were better. I thought his answer when he actually said that he would prioritize among healthcare and energy and controlling entitlement costs, whereas McCain kind of punted on that question, I thought that was kind of a big distinction between the two of them. When they moved to foreign policy, I sensed Obama flagging a little bit, McCain picking up a little bit. McCain probably won the question on Russia, for example. But I think on the question of negotiating with enemies, I think, again, like the first time, Obama held his ground on that question.
Virtually all the morning papers put the British bank bailout on their front pages. The Telegraph calls it a day of reckoning, while the Times says that taxpayers are on the hook. The FT and the Mail see it as a very unusual step politically, the FT calling it nationalisation, and the Mail saying that the banks are coming under state control. Otherwise, The Sun and The Mirror choose different leads. The Sun focuses on a woman it calls the mother of all council houses, naming a mother of seven children who it claims is being paid £170,000 a year in benefits and lives in a £1.2 million mansion. The Mirror once again has a story about its new favourite hunk, Danny Cipriani, the Wasps rugby player, saying he was battered by his teammates in a practice. Back to our main story now, and after another day of sharp falls in share prices of the banks, the government has announced its comprehensive rescue package. Details were finalised last night at crisis talks at Downing Street between the Prime Minister, the Chancellor, the Governor of the Bank of England and the Chair of the Financial Services Authority. Alistair Darling, who had faced charges of dithering, made a statement this morning before the markets opened. He said the government's plans would put the banks on a longer-term sound footing. The package is worth £50 billion. Funds will be made available to UK banks. In return, the government will receive preference shares in those institutions. That means they won't be able directly to influence management decisions, but the banks will get the capital they need to do business. Our business correspondent, Fiona Walsh, is here. This is an extraordinary moment, isn't it, Fiona?
It is either a day of reckoning or certainly a momentous occasion. We have never seen anything like this before. It is extraordinary. But as the Prime Minister is apparently going to say at his press conference later today, extraordinary times call for a bold and far-reaching solution.
What are the consequences of taking the government, taking a stake in banks?
Effectively, the banks are being part nationalised. They will, the government will use our money, taxpayers' money, equivalent to about £2,000 per taxpayer, and they will take preference shares in the bank. This means we will have a stake in the bank. It'll hugely increase government borrowing, and the key thing is, we really don't know whether this will work. It was only 5 days ago that the US Congress finally passed the $700 billion bailout plan for the American financial system. Since then, the Dow Jones has plunged. It was down another 500 points yesterday. That hasn't worked. Will this work?
I guess there's a whole set of other consequences too, including the public reaction. And do we have any indication about what the public will think about it?
Well, we certainly do, because the Guardian readers have been commenting, and they are not happy about it at all. A couple of the comments, why should my taxpayers' money be thrown at them? Also, people are pointing out, why didn't the government do this for the miners or for the rover workforce? So I think there is a risk, A, that it won't work, and B, that there'll be a huge backlash.
Overnight, it's clear as well that around the world, not just in Britain, because even this, because this only addresses the situation in Britain, that the situation around the world is getting worse.
Yeah, to a certain extent, the British banking bailout is almost a sideshow globally. The markets have gone further into free fall on the back of the Dow's fall. Japan has had a torrid time overnight, almost 1,000 points slashed from the index. Over 9%. The same in Australia. Australia made the shock decision to cut interest rates by a full percentage point yesterday. That hasn't worked. There are calls now for Britain's MPC to cut rates tomorrow by at least half a point. Some people are calling for a full point. But will that work? We really don't know.
Fiona Walsh speaking to Guardian Daily's Matt Wells.
Well, although no country is immune from the financial turmoil, it's Iceland that's feeling the pinch hardest. Its second biggest bank was nationalised yesterday, leaving more than 300,000 British customers of the Icesave online bank unable to withdraw their savings. The Guardian's John Henley is in Reykjavik.
They're a remarkably kind of phlegmatic people, the Icelanders. A lot of them seem to say, you know, we're used to these kind of booms and busts in a way. A very small rock, basically, perched in the middle of the North Atlantic. You know, I mean, Iceland has a population roughly the sort of the size of Coventry, really, and it's reliant. It has been reliant up until very recently, almost exclusively on fishing, which is obviously a bit of a hit and miss affair, or can be. Several people mentioned to me, you know, a very, very bleak period in the early 80s when the herring simply disappeared for a few years, and the national currency went through the floor, the krona went through the floor then as well. They seem to be, they're quite angry, many of them, about the very aggressive and expansionistic sort of young breed of Icelandic businessmen, the ones who've been buying up so many shops on the British High Street, for example, and the ones that have been that are at the head of these major banks, which obviously, you know, have a, I mean, they're punching the Icelandic banks and investment companies punch way above their weight, way above the country's weight in the international economic community, and a lot of particularly, I guess, sort of 30-something Icelanders, people who have kind of known nothing other than the good times, which have been going on now for about 15 years or so, you know, and who own sort of luxury four-wheel drive cars and very smart apartments and what have you, they're quite bitter because they are actually the ones who are most likely to suffer.
John Henley, and there's full coverage of the banking crisis today at guardian.co.uk. Also on The Guardian's website today, Haith Abdul Ahad reports from inside Dubai's labour camps. That's at guardian.co.uk/world. Roseanne Barr is interviewed by Christine Eiley at guardian.co.uk/G2. And as Google Earth offers views of the ocean floor, guardian.co.uk/environment selects some of the more striking underwater landscapes. Well, as we've just heard, the government of Iceland nationalised the country's second biggest bank yesterday. The law allowing it to do so was passed just a day earlier. It also said that it was negotiating a 4 billion euro loan from Russia to shore up the nation's finances. Well, Russia itself hasn't been immune to the global market turmoil, as our Moscow correspondent Luke Harding explains.
Well, it's been pretty dismal for Russia, like more or less everywhere. I mean, the two main stock markets here have been kind of tanking, really, ever since this started, with kind of huge falls every day. And the regulators here sort of suspending trading, sometimes two or three times a day. I mean, having said all that, the big picture is that Russia, despite everything, is still sitting on a mountain of money. It has a stabilization fund of more than $500 billion and the world's third largest currency reserve. So even though things are grim and foreign investors have been fleeing the country even before the war in Georgia, which of course didn't help in August, the Russian situation, the government situation, is quite strong.
And what can you tell us, Luke, about this 4 billion euro deal between Russia and Iceland? Iceland obviously in dire straits at the moment.
Yes, poor Iceland, of course, they don't have any oil. I mean, unlike Russia, you know, which is basically the world's largest exporter of gas and the second largest producer of oil and is earning $800 million a day from its oil revenue. And it was a slightly confusing day because earlier on there was a denial that this deal was going off. And then later on, Alexei Kudrin, the Russia's finance minister, said indeed that he was bailing out Iceland to the tune of 4 billion euros. Now, it seems a lot, but for Russia at the moment, that's a relatively small amount. This is the first time I've ever heard of kind of, you know, Icelandic-Russian friendship, but I can only assume that relations are pretty good.
Now, another story that you've been working on, Luke, unrelated to the credit crunch, is about Dmitry Medvedev, the Russian president. He's made his first podcast.
Well, he has indeed. I mean, he's sort of expanding his views on European collective security ahead of a international summit in France. And I have to say, I thought he did rather well. I mean, Medvedev, unlike Putin, is comparatively young. He's 43 years old. Putin is now 56 and doesn't really like or I think, probably understand the internet, whereas Medvedev has been using it since 1996 and is a bit of a kind of nethead. He logs on every morning. And, there he is on the Kremlin website. He's sort of leaning back in his chair, you know, fiddling with his mouse. And then you know, very suavely, he turns to the camera and he says sort of, "Dear friends." And, yeah, I think the boy done well.
1996, that's actually quite an early internet user. And apparently he reads the foreign press online. Does that mean he's a Guardian reader?
Well, judging from kind of Russia's recent invasion of Georgia, I suspect he's not an avid Guardian reader. But maybe I'm surmising here. But, yeah, I mean, he says that he started using the internet at the time and it was sort of deemed exotic. And you know, he still does it. And Kremlin analysts here are saying that he's not just a sort of post-Soviet leader. He's a sort of post-post-Soviet leader, which I think is an interesting point. But we do have to bear in mind that generally the media in Russia is very controlled, although the internet is free. Russian TV is a kind of postmodern sort of propaganda fest. The first 10 minutes every evening are always devoted to what, you know, Putin and Medvedev have done, even if what they've done is not very interesting. So, you know, while he sort of espouses, you know, cyberspace, at the same time domestically, the Kremlin is very hard for critics to appear anywhere at all.
Luke Harding in Moscow. My name's John Dennis. Still to come on Guardian Daily, in the US elections, we'll hear from New York on how Jewish voters regard Barack Obama.
I think he's trying to hide a little bit his Muslim background. Not that he is Muslim, he might be, or he has probably leanings.
Russian literature now. Rowan Williams took 3 months off from his job as the Archbishop of Canterbury to write a book on Dostoevsky. Williams has long been interested in Dostoevsky and wrote his doctorate on Russian Christianity. The Guardian's Stuart Jeffries met him at Lambeth Palace and asked him why Dostoevsky was relevant today.
I first read Devils, I think, in about 1971. And one thing I remember very vividly still is, having had a little bit of my share of student radicalism, thinking that the depiction of the radical students meeting was horribly recognisable. The kinds of arguments, the kind of personalities,
yeah.
The obsessional quality of it all. I thought, oh, yeah. been there. And that's just a very small bit of the whole spectrum here, but I think that what's going on in Devils about what happens where you have like a reduction of politics to management, the giving over of that management into the hands of people who have no moral hinterland, it rings a few bells in the contemporary world, because it eventually privileges the person who is the most skillful manipulator. So the person who emerges triumphantly from that dreadful book, and it's a really frightening book as well as a very funny one, the person who emerges quite unscathed is the manipulator-in-chief, the one who has known exactly how to fine-tune all these radical groups with their naivety and their short-sightedness and narrowness and made them perform according to his will. And you realize at the end of the day, it doesn't matter a bit to him. Now, that's not contemporary politics, but it just prompts the question. So when you don't have real shared values, real common goals in the society, aren't you going to be a bit at the mercy of the manipulator? How do you check that and control that? How do you avoid politics falling into the hands of, well, you know, the person who can press the most right buttons at the right moments, but who has no particular goals or aims himself or herself? As always with Dostoevsky, it's kind of projection to the extreme. It's not saying that this is what it's like, and it probably wasn't like that in the 1850s, 1860s. But the question's there.
You do have it, having saying that the atheists do not have a foundation. That, you know, the famous quotation is that without God, everything's permitted. That's not quite what you're saying. I mean, in fact, this represents a different test for what a good ethical foundation could be.
Yes, and I think what's interesting in Dostoevsky that while he says or puts into the mouth of certain people, without God, everything is permitted, he allows you to see that there are people with all sorts of beliefs and levels of unbelief who are decent, compassionate, and loving. There are confused people. There are sceptical people. There are silly people like Stepan and Devils, and they still manage somehow to wriggle their way towards decency. He's not writing them off. But I think when that without God everything is permitted dictum comes up, what he's saying is not so much without God everybody would be bad, as without God we'd have no way of connecting one act with another, no way of developing a life that made sense. It would be really indifferent whether we did this or that. And I think it's that sense of God being part of what you draw on to construct a life that makes sense.
This Friday on Music Weekly, we talked to piano popsters Keane about rehab and coping with fame. Saint Etienne described the glory days of 90s London, and there's new music from Deer Hunter, EPMD and Grace Jones, plus Michael Hannon's 60s pop group The Left Bank. That's all at guardian.co.uk/music.
Back to the US election campaign, finally, and attention has become focused on one group whose allegiances are normally not in doubt. Most Jewish voters normally back the Democratic candidate in huge numbers. Around 80% backed John Kerry and Al Gore. But there seems to be much less Jewish enthusiasm for Barack Obama, and that could make all the difference in a couple of crucial states. So how do Jewish voters feel about the choice this year? This report by Jason Solomons, the presenter of our Sounds Jewish podcast, begins in that most Jewish of American cities, New York.
Israel is not the most important issue for me as a Jew. The economy is the most important issue to me in this election. I am 100% without question planning on voting for Obama.
I have a feeling that the McCain commitment to Israel is perhaps more etched in stone, whereas the Obama one is left a little more nebulous than I'm comfortable with.
I think he's trying to hide a little bit his Muslim background. Not that he is Muslim, he might be, or he has probably leanings towards Muslim.
I think McCain is an anti-woman, anti-progressive politics, anti-civil rights, like anti-world that I want to live in candidate.
As you can hear from the streets of New York, their Jewish voters are by no means completely behind Barack Obama. So what to do to bring anyone who strays back on side? The princess of Jewish American comedy, or maybe that should be the Jewish princess of American comedy, Sarah Silverman, has been deployed to focus on the crucial state of Florida, a must-win state with a large population of retired Jews, of course. It's like no party political broadcast I've ever heard.
If Barack Obama doesn't become the next president of the United States, I'm going to blame the Jews. I am. And I know you're saying like, oh my God, Sarah, I can't believe you're saying this. Jews are the most liberal, scrappy, civil rightsy people there are. Yes, that's true. But you're forgetting a whole large group of Jews that are not that way. And they go by several aliases. Nana, Papa, Zadie, Bubby. Plain old grandma and grandpa, these are the people who vote in Florida. And the Florida vote can make or break an election. If you don't think that's true, why don't you think back to two elections ago when a little man named Al Gore got fucked by Florida? I'm making this video to urge you, all of you, to schlep over to Florida and convince your grandparents to vote Obama. It can make the difference.
Well, that hilarious advert is the handiwork of a new campaign group, JewsVote.org, set up to persuade wavering Jews to come back home to the Democratic Party. Sounds Jewish met up with JewsVote.org co-founder Ari Wallach in New York.
About 4.5 months ago, I received what might have been my 14th email forwarded to me from my mother, where it was basically a litany of slurs and smears against Senator Barack Obama. And I could tell that hundreds of people had actually read this email, but not one person actually made a comment like, huh, you know what, maybe he actually isn't a Muslim, or he didn't go to a madrasa. And at that point, I started talking to some friends about doing something, probably online, to counter the smears. And that's when I was introduced to my co-founder, Mick Moore. And from there, just as they say, it's a quick history. We started the Jewish Council for Education and Research, a PAC that would allow us to actually raise funds to activate two projects. One, JewsVote.org, which is basically a Facebook meets MoveOn.org for Jews. So people can upload their contacts and send out not just anti-smear emails on Obama into their networks, but actually emails that have information around Obama's stance on the Middle East, social policy, domestic policy, and foreign policy. Our second initiative is thegreatschlep.com. And thegreatschlep.com is focusing on connecting the Facebook generation with their grandparents, specifically in Florida. What we realized is that no matter how many emails you send, there's nothing beats face-to-face conversation, especially from loved ones. And we know that grandparents love no one more than their grandkids. We are getting emails from grandparents in Florida saying, I just got this, you know, I just got off the phone with my grandchild in New Jersey. This is amazing. You guys exist. And having had a conversation with my grandchild, I recognized that some of the ideas that I had around Senator Obama were just rumors and innuendo. And, you know, I now feel much more comfortable pulling the lever for Obama on November 4th. I've had to have a great schlep conversation with my mother, and I am still actually having it. Victory is close at hand in my family, and I think she's almost there. I think there's a few more things I have to kind of work on, but eventually she will pull the lever for Obama, I believe, come November 4th.
Ari Wallach, ending that report by Jason Solomons. And you can hear the full edition of Jason's podcast at guardian.co.uk/soundsjewish. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.